No microphone. Don't need a microphone. Ladies and gentlemen, would you like to take a seat, please? Rabbi Cooperman, Reverend Cooperman, the seats at the front here. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome here to the Lubavitch Center and to the inaugural lecture marking the opening and celebrating the opening of the Blema Lorry Library. Now, just to give you a little bit of background detail for those people who don't know, we were trying to work out, Hilton and myself, exactly when this was, but it's probably something like 20 years ago. We were very fortunate that Mr. Clem Lorry, Hilton's father, who should be gesund, took an interest in developing the library here in the centre. In fact, we didn't have a library at that time, and he dedicated and helped us to start the library there, and that became the Lorry Cohen Library. Lorry from Mr. Lorry's side, and Cohen from Mrs. Blema Lorry's side. I should say straight away at the outset today that we wish Mr. Lorry refuah shleima. Unfortunately, he's indisposed and he can't be here with us tonight. But in Mitzvah Hashem, we hope it's nothing serious and that he's going to be with us in many, many future occasions, Be'ezras Hashem. At that time, the library was upstairs and it's grown since then steadily. Many of you will remember Rabbi Rappaport. He built up a very special collection of shilas and tshuvas, primarily the Hebrew library, but we also simultaneously built up the English library. And we're still, it's work in process. We're trying to enlarge the English library particularly so that it should become more and more an asset to the Leeds community. Recently, unfortunately just over 2 years, we all know the very, very sad passing of Hilton's dear mother, Alaa Shalom Blema. And they went through, of course, the period of mourning. I've had a very close friendship with the family over many, many years and spent quite a lot of time visiting and spending time talking with Mr. Clem Lorry. And at a certain time in the last year, we got together and Mr. Lorry very, very kindly and again generously, with unbelievable generosity, agreed that it was maybe time that we should give the library a new, as it were, breath of life, and that we would rededicate it in memory of his dear wife and Hilton's dear mother. And that's what we've done. A few months ago, we came here, it was a private gathering that we came here, and we officially made that this would be now the Blema Lorry Library. There's a picture of Mrs. Lorry, Alaa Shalom, here. And that's enabled us to make this room very, very beautiful, to put new shelves in, and gradually we're starting to expand the stock of the books as well. And particularly, we want to expand the English side of the library. Now, with the advent of the internet, of course, libraries, there's a whole argument in the country. We hear the debate whether our libraries needed, are they not needed. For Jewish people, it's not really a question. At least once every week, we have Shabbos, we have Yom Tovim, we have other times. And when we study, I know that people walk around with their Blackberries and their iPods and their whatever it is and their phones. But at the end of the day, you need books to study from. You need books to learn from and read. And we believe that there's still a tremendous lot of need for a proper library with actual physical books in it. And we want to look to ways to make the community appreciate what we have here as an asset. The beauty of having this lovely Blema Lorry Library. So this is the reason why we thought we'd start with a series of lectures. And I say start, we hope there's going to be an ongoing process, that we're going to have different lectures on different topics, related in some way to Jewish knowledge, the history of the Jewish people. That's a very favourite topic of Mr. Lorry Sr. And it's again, we're very sad that he can't be with us tonight, but I'm sure he's going to be with us on future occasions. It's now for me to introduce our guest lecturer, the first of the series that we're going to be having. Our lecturer is a very, very esteemed historian in the Anglo-Jewish community. And he goes way beyond that. He's an international speaker who goes around, practically around the world at different times, lecturing on different parts of Jewish and different aspects of Jewish history. Dr. Naftali Lowenthal is a lecturer. He lectures in Jewish spirituality at UCL, University College London, the University of London. He works in the Department of Hebrew and Jewish Studies. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. He is also a senior teacher at the Girls Senior Lubavitch School in London. He has many, many other roles. He is a person whom people turn to as an expert in Jewish history. So I'm very, very delighted that he's agreed to come and honor us with a lecture today. The title of his talk tonight is going to be The Role of Jewish Women. I should get this right, shouldn't I? The Role of Women in European Jewry from the 16th century through to the 20th century. Without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Lowenthal and ask him to address us.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Andriyafi. It's very wonderful to be here, and especially at the inauguration of this library in memory of Lima Lari, Alea Shalom, Zechron Libracha. It's a great honor to be able to be with you on this occasion. Since it's the inauguration of a library, I think that the period that will be under discussion will be slightly stretched so as to somehow include a wider range of Jewish literature, so that we have representative books from all the different periods that we might expect to have on the library shelves, and we do have indeed already. So when we're considering the role of women, the role of the Jewish woman in life, focusing on Jews of Europe, 16th to 20th centuries, and certain background concepts that we have to address in order to investigate that. And I thought of certain iconic texts. Now, one of them is the Eshet Chayil prayer, or passage from the Book of Proverbs, which it's the end of the Book of Proverbs by King Solomon. And it is the passage which in English reads, a woman of valor. A woman of valor who can find. Now, I'm actually going to read you a translation of this. From the Siddur, because this is recited every Friday night, and one aspect of this is that it's a praise of the wife of the household. And I wasn't actually able to discover the very beginning of this custom. Rabbi Meir is reported in the Midrash to have declared about his wife Beruria. He said about her, Eshet Chayil Miyimtsa, who can find such a woman of valor? He was very impressed with her sagacity. Now, in the 16th century, Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi Horovitz wrote a great Kabbalist and popularizer of Kabbalistic thought. He's called the Shloh, because he wrote a book called the Shnei Luchot HaBrit, the Two Tablets of the Covenant. In this, he also wrote a Siddur, he wrote a prayer book. In his prayer book, we have Eshet Chayil on Friday night, the way it is in all, virtually all, I think, prayer books today. I haven't been able to find an earlier source. I looked digitally through the Machzor Vitri, and I couldn't find it, but maybe it was just something wrong with my software. Machzor Vitri is a very early text giving us Ashkenazi Jewish customs. But anyway, let me just read this briefly, and we'll consider, who can find a wife of excellence, a woman of valor, who can find? Her value far exceeds that of gems. The heart of her husband trusts in her. He lacks no gain. She treats him with goodness, never with evil, all the days of her life. She seeks out wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings food from afar. She rises while it's still night, gives food to her household, sets out the tasks for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She girds her loins with strength and flexes her arms. She realizes that her enterprise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands on the spindle, her palms grasp the distaff. She holds out her hand to the poor and extends her hands to the destitute. She doesn't fear for her household in the frost, for her entire household is clothed warmly in scarlet. She makes her own tapestries. Her garments are of fine linen and purple. Her husband is well known at the gates as he sits with the elders of the land. She makes linens and sells them. She provides the merchants with girdles. Strength and dignity are her garb. She looks smilingly towards the future. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She watches the conduct of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise and acclaim her. Her husband, he praises her. Many daughters have done worthily, but you surpass them all. Charm is sometimes deceptive. Beauty might be vanity, but a God-fearing woman is the one to be praised. Give her praise for her accomplishments. Let her deeds laud her at the gates. Now that's a beautiful poem. It's also described as being about the Shekhinah, the divine presence, which is there in the home on a Friday night. But it is the divine presence is the sort of supernal dimension of womanhood, the Kabbalists tell us. And so womanhood here in this world is the wife who is sitting at the table and has organized the whole beautiful Shabbat meal and has lit the candles and the daughters with her. So this is a kind of an iconic text. And in terms of this, what are, you know, can we define what are the basic parameters of womanhood? And I suggest four parameters. There's family. We see her with her husband, her children. They laud her. She inspires them. Business activity. She's a very active person, this lady in the book of Proverbs. Now, Torah study, you see, it has the interesting phrase, Piha patcha b'chokhmah. Her mouth is open with wisdom. So she's wise as well. She's not just she's not only a person who is very active. She also has a mind and a head and wisdom with teachings of kindness. And she, there is a spiritual dimension as well. She's God fearing. That's in it. She gives charity, the poor. She helps the poor, the destitute. So those four general topics: family, business activity, Torah study, personal piety and spirituality. Now, of course, Torah study and piety / spirituality do sort of merge one with the other, but we can consider these four different areas. Now, this helps us consider the way in which in European Jewish thought, people thought about women and women acted and sometimes wrote about themselves. But there's another iconic text, and of course this library already has it, I believe, which is the Talmud. What are the Talmudic images of womanhood, right? So people in Europe, from the very beginning, when we start talking about Rabbeinu Gershom Mo'or HaGola in the 11th century, 10th, 11th century, and then Rashi two generations later, the Talmud was the text of Europe. People studying the Talmud, as I'm sure it will be in this library and is in this library as well. So what are the Talmudic images of womanhood? Well, of the family, it's ubiquitous. All the way through the Talmud, we have the concept of a father, mother, and children. That's the way in which the Talmud thinks. Everything else that is happening in the Talmud has to do a man, his wife, his son, daughter, duties of children to parents, duties of parents to children, relationship between husband and wife. That's very, very much a perennial theme throughout the Talmudic literature. What about business? do we see women as conducting business in the Talmud? Funnily enough, not as much as we might expect. But I did notice an article by someone called Shumalit Vala from Haifa University, Business Women in the Mishnaic and Talmudic Period. And she went through the Talmud and she found all kinds of like little situations where you see that a woman is buying a field or selling it, and things of this kind where women are involved with buying and selling of property and other kinds of business ventures. It's not at the forefront of Talmudic thought. It's not there on every page, but Shulamit Vala did manage to find a whole lot of examples, and you can even read her whole article online if you want to, as I did. So, so that's available there. Now, what about Talmudic attitudes regarding Torah study and women? Yes, that's how we've got family, business activity, Torah study. Now, what about that that concept? Now, the Talmud is famous for its statements which somehow seem to negate the idea of Torah study for women. The Talmud itself is an extremely intriguing book. It's fascinating. One could really call it a kind of a postmodern construct of Jewish thought. You see, the Talmud constructs images of what is permitted and what is forbidden, what is pure and what is impure. Then the Talmud says, in order for you to be a good Talmud scholar, you have to be able to prove in 150 different ways that a sheretz is something like a dead rat or something like that. A sheretz is a thing which is impure. That an impure thing, which the Torah says clearly is impure, you've got to be a good Talmudist, you have to be able to prove in 150 ways that it's pure. You've got to prove that black is white, or that white is black. And if you can't do that, you can't be a good Talmudist. Perhaps this is why in South Korea they instituted the study of Talmud in the hope that this will make them rich like the Jews around the world, and maybe they'd even get to control the media and everything else that we do. But the anxiety of the Talmud, given that this was regarded as the art of Talmudic dueling, as it were, they were worried about women learning that same art. They thought it would somehow, you couldn't carry through the same innocence, if you like, and purity of womanhood if you've got this devious power to be able in 150 different ways to prove that black is white. However, and so as a result, there are these negative statements about women studying Talmudic thought. However, despite that, we have a number of women in the Talmud who are famous as having knowledge. One of them is Bruria, very famous. I mentioned her before, the wife of Rabbi Meir. And she is said to have learned from the rabbis 300 halachot on a single day. It says in Psachim 62b. And she was a very, she challenged people. She when she spoke with rabbis, including her father and other people as well, she would challenge what they were saying, and the Talmud praises her sagacity. In fact, it went further than simply her understanding of Talmudic thought, because there was a tragedy in her life, because they had two children. One second before that, there was a they had some very nasty neighbors, unfortunately, and she and her husband, and she was shocked to hear her husband praying, you know, like the worst thing should happen to these neighbors, and she was very upset by this. She said, what do you mean? It says in Tehillim, Yitamu chataim min haaretz, let, what does chatayim mean? Let sins disappear from the earth, and then there won't be any more wicked people. It doesn't say let sinners disappear. You don't have to pray that the sinners should disappear. Pray that sins will disappear, and automatically the Roshayim, the wicked people, will repent. So Rabbi Meir was very struck by this. And then later, the Midrash tells us, that was the Midrash on Psalms, on Psalm 118. The Midrash on the Book of Proverbs tells us that unfortunately, tragically, their two sons died suddenly on the Shabbat. And her husband came home, and he didn't know, and she has to break the news to him. She said, someone lent us something very precious, and now they want it back. What do you think we should do? He says, well, of course, if someone lent us, what have they lent us? If they've lent us something very precious, they want it back, we better give it back to them. So she said, well, that's what's happened. And she took him into the room and she showed him the two sons, unfortunately. And it was at that point that he said, Eshet Chayil Mi Yimtza, who can find a woman of valor? That was when Rabbi Meir was so impressed with her. Another famous lady in the Talmud is the daughter of Rav Chisda, who we actually don't find out her name. She's always called the daughter of Rav Chisda. She married Rava, a famous Amora. There were the Tanaim and then the Amoraim in Babylon. And he married her. And they had clearly a very close relationship. And sometimes she was able to tell him off. One day, a man came to Rava, who was the rabbi of the town. Man came to Rava and said to him, is this animal which had been slaughtered, is it kasher? So Rava said, yes, it's kasher. He examined the animal and he said, yes, it's kasher. And then Rava bought some meat from the man who was selling who had slaughtered the animal and is a butcher and is the meat is for sale. Rava bought the meat from him. So his wife, the daughter of Rav Chisda, says to him, my father would never do a thing like that. The man came to my father with a bechor, a firstborn, and you can't, with the firstborn animal, the only thing you can do is if the animal has a flaw of some kind, a mum, a blemish, then it can be used in an ordinary way and it can be slaughtered. So my father permitted a bechor, a firstborn animal, to be slaughtered, but he wouldn't have bought from that because it would be seen as some kind of bribery. The man who sells him the meat will sell it a bit cheaper, and therefore that's a kind of a bribery to him to say that this firstborn animal can be slaughtered. So Rava says, well, look, I think the case is different because that's true when you're talking about a firstborn animal. Here, we're not talking about with this animal that's been slaughtered here. The shopkeepers always give me the best part of the animal. So he's going to do that anyway. So I can't do anything about that. So the fact that I permitted it. But it's very interesting. The Talmud records this whole interchange between them. And the way that she was a critical voice. She wasn't just a yes man. She was a critical voice. And and then we see another incident in Chulin 44b. This was what I just told you was in Chulin 44b. In Ketubot 85a, there's a courtroom scene. Rava is the judge. He is about to take testimony from a certain witness, who was a woman. His wife, the daughter of Rav Chisda, as she's always called, his wife says to him, I wouldn't trust that woman. All right? Okay. So because she said that, he accepts what she said. A line later, Rav Papa, who is one of the esteemed rabbis, also makes a comment about someone, and Rava says, well, I can't accept your comment. You're only one witness, and one witness doesn't count. So Rav Papa says, you don't accept my words, because you say I'm only one witness, but your wife, you do accept her words. So Rava says, I know her, she's reliable. You, I'm not so sure about. These were unusual women. We have the wife of Rabbi Akiva. There are who was the one who encouraged him to become a great Torah scholar. There are a number of other such images in the Talmud. And then we have the whole concept of the piety of womanhood. Do we see women as pietists? We see them as sharp, as clever, as pietists. Well, one kind of piety, Rabbi Yochanan heard, this is, we learn fear of sin from a young woman. Rabbi Yochanan heard a certain young woman, she fell on her face and she prayed to God. She said, Creator of the universe, you've created the Garden of Eden and you've created Gehinnom. You've created Tzaddikim, you've created Rishayim. May it be your will that no one will stumble over me. In other words, no one will somehow think about her in the wrong way, and as a result of that will stumble morally, and so she's asking God for that protection. It's interesting, she doesn't ask, I shouldn't stumble. I shouldn't see a nice young man in the marketplace and start thinking inappropriate thoughts about him. So we might consider this later. Another example of piety, the same passage, which is in Sota, page 22b, goes on to say, there was a certain widow who had a synagogue right next to where she lived. But every day, and this is also interesting, every day she would go and pray in the Beit HaMedrash of Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan said to her, my daughter, haven't you got, that was the way people spoke to a lady, an esteemed rabbi would speak to her, haven't you got a synagogue in your, just near where you live? She said, Rabbi, don't I get a reward for walking further? Just the fact that I'm walking further to get to the synagogue, don't I get extra reward for that? And so we there see this concept of women who express a relationship with the divine and a concern to be close to God in different ways. Now, of course, in Talmudic law, it is permitted for men to marry more than one wife. But in fact, we don't find any single Tana or Amora where it says he had one wife this and another wife that. We just don't find it. Whenever it is mentioned that there is a rabbi and his wife, it's always just one wife. We never see mention of a second wife at the same time, even though in theory this would be possible according to Jewish law at that stage. Now this is where we come from the Talmud into Europe, and we come to the beginning of European Jewry. One of the theories about where European Jewry come from is that the Romans took Jews as slaves, basically, or in various ways, round the Roman Empire. And then the Roman Empire broke up, and there were Jews left in all the different, like scattered around the Mediterranean. The lovely map here would need to have a few more bits in order for us to see this whole Mediterranean basin and around it. And so there were many Jews in Franco-Germany, France and Germany, which are Ashkenaz. There were Jews in Spain. And there are different stories about the way in which Torah teaching came to each of those places. There's a theory that Charlemagne brought some a family of rabbis from Sicily called the Calonymus family, and he brought them to France, and they became the leaders of Ashkenazi Jewry. And so Rabbeinu Gershom, Ma'or HaGola, the light of the exile, 960 to 1040, he was the first very great sage of whom we know, and he's famous particularly for these groups of rabbis coming together, which he organized, making various takanot, making various enactments, and his most famous enactments have to do with women. There are two. One is the prohibition of a man taking more than one wife. So what we see, and probably in the Talmudic period was already, that was the style. Although it was permitted to have more than one wife, most people didn't do so, and certainly not learned, scholarly people. But Rabbeinu Gershom actually made that an enactment, that a man should have, could not marry more than one wife. And a second enactment, that a man could not divorce a woman against her will. Now that's a very important concept, because in the Talmudic tractate Gittin about divorces, God forbid, there are all kinds of possibilities of a man somehow or other giving his wife a divorce, she doesn't really know what it is, and then she opens, oh God, it's a divorce. And that was stopped by Rabbeinu Gershom. Now the two enactments together do give a wife a certain level of power. If a man could have more than one wife, and his wife refuses to accept a divorce, so he could say, alright, so don't accept a divorce, I'm not going to have, God forbid, he says he's not going to have anything more to do with her, and he'll marry someone else. Ah, but you can't marry another wife. And so therefore, he is forced into a relationship where there might be some kind of mediation, or at least she is not left penniless. There's some kind of power that is being granted to her, and it can happen that someone wants to get divorced and his wife doesn't want to accept the divorce, and more common, unfortunately, is the other way around, the aguno, the wife who wants to get divorced, and the husband won't grant it. And so then there are other ways of trying to grant her that. However, this was a very substantial step right at the beginning of Ashkenazi Jewry as we know it. Now, another step, another very important point, as mentioned, Rabbeinu Gershom, he taught a group of students, and one of the next generation after that was Rashi. And Rashi is famous for writing a commentary on the whole Chumash, the five books of Moses, the rest of Tanakh, the whole Tanakh, in other words, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, and almost the entire Talmud. There are one or two tractates where Rashi didn't complete the commentary or didn't write the commentary, but most of the Talmud has a commentary by Rashi and a further commentary, a further discussion by his students called the Tosafists. Now Rashi's daughters are very famous. They become even more famous now because a number of books have been put out about Rashi's daughters. I'm not sure how far it's extended into the media, whether film or... But Rashi's daughters is now a shemdova. It's a significant concept. Let's hear a little bit about these daughters: Yocheved, Miriam, and Rachel. It's interesting. Yocheved and Miriam are the two midwives in the book of Exodus, and Yocheved is the mother of Moses, and Miriam is the sister of Moses. Anyway, these were powerful women. Yocheved married Rab Meir ben Shmuel, and they had four sons, and each one of them was famous as a scholar. Their sons, two of them are very famous. There was Rabbeinu Tam, famous scholar, and Rashbam, a famous Bible commentator. There was also Rab Yitzchok, who was the Rivam, and Solomon the grammarian. They called him Solomon, even though his father or grandfather Shloima, that's Rashi, was still alive, which is interesting. Later Ashkenazi custom is not to do that, but Sfardi is, of course. So now there are a number of legends about Rashi's daughters, one of which has some kind of textual source, is that Rashi says that he was very weak, and so he couldn't write. There is a responsum that he's writing. You see, Rashi, apart from writing all these commentaries, also wrote responses to rabbinic questions. and response. So he's saying, I'm too weak to write, so I'm dictating it to my daughter. So if he says he's dictating it to his daughter, obviously she is a wise woman who's able to write down a Hebrew text in an accurate way. This makes it, that's quite a significant statement in terms of the level of education of Rashi's daughter. However, I must tell you that there's another text of the same responsum which says I'm dictating it to the son of my daughter. So not to my daughter, but my son, the son of my daughter. So then there's a question, you know, was it that someone thought it was funny that his daughter is writing it down, and so they interpolated the word son, or, you know, what is the truth? We don't know. But anyway, that's a little bit of a suggestion that his daughters were indeed quite scholarly. There's also other evidence that his granddaughters taught Torah teachings to local women and served as models for the proper performance of Jewish rituals. In other words, you know, how do you do this and this? See what Rashi's granddaughter does. So then there's a whole discussion about whether or not women wore tefillin in Rashi's time, because it seems that Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, ruled that a woman doing any mitzvah she's not obligated to, including tefillin, must make a blessing on it. As a result of that, women shake lulav and esrog, certainly in Ashkenazi communities, and they make a blessing on it when they shake it, even though, according to, it's a mitzvah which is defined by time, a positive mitzvah affected by time, so therefore women do not have to do it, but nonetheless they do it. They've accepted it on themselves, as they've accepted on themselves the blowing of the shofar, and so therefore the woman can make a blessing on the blowing of the shofar as well. So if a man is blowing the shofar just for a group of women, and he's already heard the shofar, one of the women makes the blessing on the blowing of the shofar, and he's able to blow. So the third legend seems a bit far-fetched, but who knows? And the third legend is that the commentary by Rashi, supposedly on Tractate Nedarim, is clearly not by him. So who wrote it? So a suggestion somewhere, I haven't in any way been able to track down the first place, the first time this suggestion was made. Rashi's daughters wrote the commentary on Tractate Nedarim. So I don't know whether there's any credence whatsoever. But, you see, from a historical point of view, when you get a story of this kind, it's very interesting to find out when the story began, because the presence of the story may not tell us anything about Rashi and his daughters, but it may tell us about the time when people began to say that story. It tells us something about that. So whether that is a feature of the modern period or earlier is an interesting thing. I don't know. There are actually, in consideration of this paper, I found... someone had put together a bibliography of articles about Jewish women in the Middle Ages, no less than 350 academic articles on different aspects of the life of Jewish women in the Middle Ages, and which again is available online, and all different aspects. Just looking through the list of what people have written is a fascinating. Fascinatingly instructive. Someone may have written or will write a discussion about this story about Rashi's daughters writing a commentary to Nedarim, and it will help us know something about some little one of the little pieces of Jewish history. Now, so this is Rashi. I want to keep on this theme of women studying Torah, and I'm going to look at a book which is written a little bit later than Rashi himself. Rashi was born in 1040, and he lived through the Crusades, 1096. But I now want to look at a book called Sefer Chasidim, the Book of the Pious. Now, this isn't relate directly to the Hasidic movement that began in the 18th century. The Book of the Pious, the Sefer Hasidim, was written around the 12th, 13th century in Franco-Germany. Very, very interesting book. I'm not sure if it's been translated yet. If it has been, I'm sure it will find a place on this, on the shelves. I hope even the Hebrew version as well will find its way here. Now here we have a quote from the Book of the Pious, Sefer Chassidim. A man has the duty to teach his daughters the mitzvahs, like halachic decisions. What it says in the Talmud, that people shouldn't teach Torah to their daughters, that means the depth of Talmud and subtleties and esoteric teaching. Those things shouldn't be taught to women or children. But the laws of the mitzvahs, you have to teach them. Because if she doesn't know the laws of Shabbat, how is she going to keep Shabbat? And similarly, all the mitzvot, you have to tell her all of them. And then it gives a number of examples of women in earlier periods of time having great Torah knowledge. So it quotes from the Talmud that in the time of King Hezekiah, women and children had great knowledge of every aspect of Jewish law. The mitzvah of Hakel, the mitzvah to gather all the Jewish people together in the temple and hear the king reading. This was all to inspire women as well as men. And then it speaks about the Shunammit. The Shunammit, the Shunammite woman, is the lady who made a little lodging room, a bedroom in her house for Elisha, the prophet. And whenever Elisha would come, he would stay in her house with her husband, and he had that room with a bed, a table, and a lamp. And then he gave her a blessing. Elisha gave her a blessing that she would have a son, and she did bear a son, and then sometime later there was a hot day and the son fell faint and he died of sunstroke or he was unconscious. And she wanted to go to see Elisha. So she went to her husband and she said, I'm going to go to the prophet Elisha. So her husband says to her, this is all in Sefer Chassidim, her husband says to her, and in the Tanakh and in the Book of Kings, her husband says, why are you going to Elisha now? It's not Rosh Chodesh and it's not Shabbat. From this we see, says Sefer Chassidim, that on Rosh Chodesh and Shabbat, the women would go to the prophet in order to hear inspiring Torah teachings from the prophets. Well, maybe they did in the Tanakh. It is certainly interesting that that's how the Book of the Pious, Sefer Chassidim, thinks of it, that women have a role and should be educated and know about the mitzvot that they have to do. Now this became a halachic principle, that a woman has to know the laws which she has to carry out. However, the spelling out of this principle in full terms took a few centuries, but nonetheless in between there were quite a number of learned and scholarly women. We start with one very famous lady, or a very famous husband. The husband is the Maharal of Prague. The Maharal of Prague was a young boy, about 14 I think, when he got engaged to his wife-to-be, who was about 12. So what did they discuss at their engagement party? He gave her a syllabus of what she had to study before they got married. And so she studied this very diligently. She then became his secretary, writing down the books that he wrote. He was a very voluminous author, wrote many, many books. And she would write down these in a fair copy, and it said that 8 times she discovered that he had erroneously quoted something. He'd given the wrong source, and she spotted it and was able to correct it. Well, that's Eshet Chayil. Now, that's in the 16th century, and that is in Prague. Her name was Pearl, by the way. Now, in 1553 in Venice, there was a book published called Mayan Ganim, The Fountain of the Gardens. And this is a book of responsa. And it is quoted in a very famous Jewish book published today, which is available, called Torah Tmima. Torah Tmima is a chumash, and it puts at the bottom of the page a number of places where that verse in the Torah is quoted in the Talmud, and it gives a discussion of this. So there is a point in the V'hayim Shemar, you should teach these things to your sons. So there's a Talmudic comment which says, this means the actual duty of study of Torah applies to men and not to women. So the Torah Tmima, the author of the Torah Tmima, called Baruch Halevi Epstein, he gives a discussion of this, and he says, I want to quote what it says in the book Mayan Ganim, which was published in Venice in 1553. He says there that the reason why the sages say that you shouldn't teach Torah to women is because many women at our time do not have such a great level of education. But there are many exceptions. And when you have such an exception, it's absolutely right to teach her as much Torah as you can, and he gives very great encouragement to extensive study of Torah by women. So that's from a page of the Torah Tmima. It's interesting that he should quote that. Now we'll come a little bit later to consider Baruch Halevi Epstein's own life experience and how he was very influenced by a particular woman, his aunt, who was a great Torah scholar. Alright, we now come to all this is about Torah scholarship, but I'd like to consider a different aspect of life. And I want to talk about a different person, a different kind of person. And this is the entrepreneur. Now, the entrepreneur could be a businesswoman buying fields, or she could be a very, very powerful businesswoman doing the most amazing things. And we're actually looking now at someone else at the other end of Europe, in Spain, in the 16th century. And we're looking at a lady called Gracia Mendes Nasi. She's also called Beatrice de Luna. She lived 1510 to 1569. She was one of the wealthiest Jewish women of the Renaissance period. She had a very powerful uncle. She was born in Lisbon in Portugal. And she was born at a point after the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Many Jews had gone to Portugal. That was in 1492. Many Jews had gone to Portugal, and then they were, in 1497, they were all forcibly converted to Christianity. And her parents were forcibly converted to Christianity, and they had got married in a cathedral. Then they had a secret Jewish wedding, and then she was born. Now, she, in various ways, her family became very wealthy traders. And they traded with the Far East. It was the spice trade which went to the Far East. And so ships would go from Lisbon to the Far, that's in Portugal, to the Far East. And then they would come back, or they would go straight from Lisbon to Antwerp. Right? Antwerp was an important port of call for this spice trade. Now, she began an escape route for Jews who'd forcibly been converted, for the conversos. There were Jews in Lisbon, they wanted to get out of the country, and they couldn't. She got them employed on her ships. She became the shipholder of this whole vast maritime empire. And she got the converso employed on her ship. The ship went from Lisbon to Antwerp. Then she got the, from Antwerp, she got them carried overland by cart going over the Alps. They would get to Venice. Very perilous journey. It had to be a secret journey, going over the Alps to get to Venice. From Venice, they were able to take a boat to the Ottoman Empire, to Turkey, where they were safe. And she was in charge of this whole thing, and there were many attempts to foil her in different ways. One of her problems was she was so wealthy, so kings of Europe were trying to force her to make her daughter marry one of their sons, because then the property of the wife would go to the husband and she would lose everything. And so she managed to avoid that, but by avoiding it, she herself was in peril, and so she herself eventually used the same escape route to get to Turkey. Now when she got to Turkey, she found out that the Pope had burnt at the stake a number of converso Jews, whom he'd accused, perhaps rightly, of keeping Judaism secretly. And he had them burnt at the stake. She had such power, she was then able to make an embargo of the papal port of Ancona. So for a number of years, there was no trade coming into Italy to the papal court, because of this was her financial revenge against this act by the Pope. So now this Gracia Beatrice da Luna, that's a woman, a female entrepreneur and hero. Now, so that's another dimension. Now we then come to the, so we've got the idea of family, and we've got the idea of business, of Torah study, the entrepreneur and hero. And let's just consider the question of spirituality. You know, the normal roots for spirituality is a library. You need books in order to give you ideas, and you use those ideas to come closer to Hashem. So in the end of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th, we have the beginning of a whole lot of fascinating books being published for women. So in 1596, Moshe ben Henoch Altshul of Prague published a book in Krakow called The Brandspiegel, the bright mirror. The copper mirror, and that is a book of ethical spiritual teachings culled from the Midrash and other places. Then we have, a few years later, was published also in Krakow the book Tzeno Urena, a famous book, which is a book of Midrashim and other stories and comments on the Torah, very much influenced by a 13th century Spanish Kabbalist. So you've got a certain Kabbalistic input taking place over there. And another book, these books are both in Yiddish. They're in Yiddish because the women mostly couldn't read, they couldn't understand Hebrew. They could read the Hebrew letters, but they couldn't understand Hebrew, but they spoke Yiddish. So these are books written in Yiddish. Lev Tov, published in 1620 in Poznan, is another book, a very inspiring book. I have a copy of it at home, and it is a kind of Shulchan Aruch. It gives a guide to daily life, but also stories and inspiring ideas. And interestingly, it counsels men to honor their wives, and it stresses that men and women have equal rights. So Lev Tov means a good heart, and it became a Yiddish saying, Zum Lev Tov darf man haben a good heart noch. As well as reading the book Lev Tov, the good heart, you also have to have a good heart. So the book became so famous that it became like a Yiddish saying around this book. Now, I worked out once that this book was published every few years. There would be another edition of the Lev Tov, another edition. Then, in 1850 or so, 1860, when Reb Shlomo Ganzfried's Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was published, the brief code of Jewish law, that seems to have eclipsed the Lev Tov, and so suddenly it stops being published. Now it's still being published as a kind of historic item, so one can still buy it, but it used to be on everyone's bookshelf. Now we come to another significant work written in Yiddish and a very famous figure, Glückel of Hamelin. Now Glückel of Hamelin was a woman. Here I have a translation. She wrote a biography towards the end of a very long and energetic life, where we see her in all these phases. We see her as a wife and as a mother. We see her as a businesswoman. We see that she is a woman of wide reading, who writes down ideas that she's read in the Talmud and in books like the Brandspiegel and Senor Rena and the Levtov, she writes down in here, in this book. She wrote in Yiddish, and this was translated into English and published here. And it's a very, very beautiful work, and you see a really inspiring person. And so she combines all these four dimensions, both as a business, very active businesswoman working together with her husband, and also as a figure in her own right, who is giving wise advice to her children and grandchildren, whom she's trying to communicate. She wrote the book so that her children and grandchildren would read it and be edified and inspired and kept on the right path of Judaism. Now we come to another dimension, which is the 18th century, the concept of Trinus. Has anyone heard of Trinus? Trinus? Yes. Trinus are little Yiddish, or quite long sometimes, Yiddish poems or texts which precede an activity like lighting Shabbos candles or making challah or various other activities in the life of a woman, putting a kugel in the oven. And there's a trina to say in Yiddish to sort of think about this. Now, a colleague, Chava Weisler, Professor Chava Weisler, very fascinating lady who worked on this for many, many years about different aspects of Trinus. She then published it in a book, Voices of the Matriarchs, to be recommended, listening to the prayers of early modern Jewish women. So she writes there about a very interesting figure called Sora Rivka Rochel Leah Horovitz. Obviously her parents had great ideas for her, and she was a very special person. So she's generally just called Leah. So her father, Rabbi Yaakov, or Yokel he's sometimes called, Rabbi Yaakov Horovitz, served as a rabbi in Bolichov Brody. Now, Brody was a very, very important Jewish community, and he studied in the Brody Klaus, which was known as a place where Kabbalists would study. So he's clearly a Kabbalist. Incidentally, according to the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, writing in his Achronos, in his memoirs, the Kabbalists were always much more enthusiastic about girls learning Torah. And he even gives he gives the information about Pearl and her husband, the Maharal of Prague, who was the ancestor of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, and various other people in his ancestry, where you would have a young woman who's been taught by her father to learn Talmud and learn Poskim, learn the codes of law and the commentaries. But she would not be able, this is like in the 18th century, she would not be able to get a shidduch if this were known. So it's kept secret. And then she gets married, and there's this scene with her and her young husband and her father walking around near Posen, or in Posen, on Shabbos, and there's an Eruv. And they are carrying Svarim and various things, and suddenly a messenger runs up and says, oh, the wire for the Eruv has broken. Right? That's why rabbis are afraid of Eruv. So the wire for the Eruv is broken, and everyone was, what should we do? We've got these Sidurim in our hands and a Talmud, this and that. And they're all looking nonplussed at each other. And her father says to her, come on, Rachel, you tell everyone what to do. So she gives them instructions what to do, bearing in mind local custom, this, that. She like comes out with a whole lot of information. And her husband is shocked. He didn't know this. And as soon as they get home, they look it up in the big Shulchan Aruch, and they see that it's exactly right what she said. And her husband had to come to terms with the fact that he married a wife who was a Talmid Chacham, who was a Torah scholar. So the Kabbalists always emphasized this study of womanhood. Now, this Sora Rachel Rivka Leah Horovitz. So her father is a very learned man. And she got married, to a man who was himself a scholar. And we get an interesting exposure to what kind of person she was from the memoirs. See, in order to find out about one person, you have to look at the memoirs of another person. So there's a person called Dov Ber Bolichov, who lived 1723 to 1805, 18th century. He says that he was being given lessons in Talmud on Shabbos afternoon, and he would go to the house of the rabbi. So he comes to the rabbi's house. Now, the point is that in the rabbi's house was living the rabbi's sister, who is Leah Horovitz, married to Rabbi Shabtai, her husband's name. And so that was the household. And he comes in, and the rabbi would give this boy a piece of Talmud to prepare. And so they're like sitting at the table, and the boy is given a piece of Talmud to prepare, and in a few minutes' time, the rabbi's going to ask him, so now say over the Talmud that you prepared. The boy would start looking at the Talmud. It's Shabbos afternoon, remember. The rabbi would fall fast asleep. Now, the rabbi's sister, who is there, married sister, who's there in the house as well, would see this boy sitting, struggling with the Talmud and not able to understand it with this like pained expression on his face. She would say, come and tell me, what's the passage you have to prepare? And he would tell her. And she would say, it's this and this. She'd explain by heart. That's how he writes it down. By heart, she would explain the whole passage. Either he had to prepare a piece of Talmud or a piece of Rashi. It's not clear if it's Rashi on the Talmud or Rashi on the Chumash. But this Leah Horovitz would explain it all to him, and in that way he would know it. Then the rabbi, her brother, would wake up, and he would say over what he's learnt from the rabbi's sister, and sure enough, he got 10 out of 10. Very good student. So that vignette we see in someone else's book. Now, Leah Horovitz wrote things herself. She wrote Trinus. And the Trinus, the most famous of the Trinus she wrote, is called Trinus Emahos, the Trina of the matriarchs. This gave Chava the idea of, I believe, the title for her book, Voices of the Matriarchs, the Emahos, Sarah Rachel Rivka Leah. So she wrote this Trina. Now, it's a very interesting Trina. It is to be said on Shabbos, where we say, which was like Shabbos yesterday, Shabbos Mevorach in HaChodesh, when we bless the new moon. So it's in three parts. First, there's a preamble in Hebrew, where she writes a whole discussion about the role of prayer for women and how important it is for women. They should pray every day, they should go to shul every day, and they should know what they're praying for. Secondly, she adds, it's not right just to pray for panosa or health of one's children only. You should also pray in a more spiritual way for the Shechina, for the divine presence, which is in exile. You should weep at the idea that the divine presence is in exile. You should be davening for Mashiach. That's how she puts it. The weeping for the divine presence in exile, which the Kabbalist, quote unquote, a real Kabbalist of that time, that's exactly what he would do, and she is saying women should be doing this as well. And she also criticizes on halachic grounds the text of the Shabbos Mevorachin Nusach, what people say in shul. You see, here in the Korban Mincha Siddur, which is an old Siddur going back 19th or earlier, may Hashem make this new month for us and the whole people of Israel for goodness and blessing, for joy and rejoicing, for salvation, for good panosa, for sustenance, for good health, for good news, for rain in its time, and for complete healing, and for redemption. Now that text, or something like it, is in many other Siddurim. She thought this was wrong, because on Shabbat we're not supposed to ask for simple parnasa. So as a result, but she thought there should be a much simpler text. And funnily enough, as Chava Weisler mentions, when Rabbi Shneur Zalman wrote his Siddur, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, the founder of Chabad, he put it in a much simpler way, May the Holy One, blessed be He, renew this month for us and for all His people, the house of Israel, for life and for peace, for gladness and joy, for deliverance and consolation, and let's say Amen. Much briefer. And it's interesting that Leah Horovitz had this idea as well. Now Rabbi Shneur Zalman is taking it from the Siddur of the Shloah, Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi Horovitz. But what is interesting is this Leah Horovitz, I'm not sure if they were related, how close, but Leah Horovitz had the same idea. Now, there is a very interesting Talmudic commentary that she gives. And this has to do really with the whole question of empowerment of a woman in relation to her husband. In the Talmud, in Sotah, it says that there are certain times that a woman has a schut. And then comes the question, what is the schut? What is the merit of women? The merit of women, of womanhood, is encouraging their husbands and children to study Torah. Okay, so if a woman, she waits up for her husband when he comes home from the study house and brings him a hot meal in the study house, various ways that a woman can encourage her husband and children. She says the word merit, she interprets it in this preamble to her trina, the trina of the matriarch. She says it doesn't just mean merit, it means being empowered. Schut in the sense of be prevailing. Zakai, meaning prevailing. In all other things, ishuk sheira oisa ritzoin baila. In all other things, a kosher woman does the will of her husband. As her husband says do this, she does that. Her husband says do something else, she does something else. But she is empowered when it comes to Torah study to persuade her husband to learn Torah. He maybe doesn't want to go and learn Torah. And she said, why don't you go to that shiur that Rabbi so-and-so is giving? Or something like that. So it's put in her hands to change what her husband wants to do to make sure that he learns Torah and her children learn Torah. Now it's interesting, later, around 1820, the Chatam Sofer in Pressburg, he changed the meaning of the words Ishak Sheira Osar Ritzon Baala, a kosher woman creates the desire of her husband. She makes her husband want the right things. She gets him to want to learn Torah, to keep mitzvot, to give charity, to do all the things that it's right that a person should do. She, so to speak, makes him, manipulates him, persuades him so that he does the right thing. This became a very favorite saying of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Ishuk Sheira Oyser Ritzoin Baila, the kosher woman fashions the true will of her husband. Now we're coming to the 18th century, we're running out of time over here, and we have a full exposition by Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi of the laws that a woman should study. He goes back to this halachic issue. A woman should study everything that she needs to know in order to carry out the halacha that applies to her. And so he goes through a whole list. I'm just showing it to you. It's here and then further. It's a whole list. It's a whole long syllabus of which the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, if a man would know everything that's written there, he would be a Talmid Chacham. And Rabbi Shneur Zalman was advising that women should be taught this. He himself taught his daughter Freda. And we now come to Baruch HaLevi Epstein's aunt. Now this was a lady called Reina Batya. She was the wife of the Netziv, a very great Lithuanian Talmud scholar. And she herself had become a Talmud scholar. She knew a tremendous amount. She knew the Babylonian Talmud, she knew the Jerusalem Talmud. But there was absolutely no context in which this could be expressed. And she was very unhappy about this. She wasn't able to give shiurim, she wasn't able to do anything with her Talmudic knowledge. And Baruch HaLevi Epstein, who wrote the Torah Tmima, also wrote his own autobiography, and there's a whole chapter about his aunt, Reina Batya, showing the frustration that she felt. Now, that's in the middle of the 19th century. Then we move into the 20th century with tremendous changes. Sora Schneera instituting, with the blessing of many Hasidic Rebbeim and others, the Beis Yaakov groups, where they would study Torah. And she set up schools all over Poland, something like 250 schools all over Eastern Europe, where young girls, young 16, 17 year olds, would be running a school teaching Torah to girls. And then we have the concept of Achos HaTmimim, which we haven't got time to discuss now, but it was a group in Riga where girls would be studying mystical teachings. They would be studying Tanya and other and Hasidic discourses. And in the 1950s, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was asked about women studying mystical teachings. Now remember, Sefer Hasidim said women shouldn't study Talmud and they shouldn't study mystical teachings, but halakha they should study. So he said, you know, there is a book called the Sefer HaChinuch, which was written by a Rishon in the 13th century. It speaks there about six continual mitzvot that apply to every Jew, man and woman. To believe in God, to recognize the unity of God, not to believe in any other power, to love God, to fear God, not to go astray after one's heart and eyes. How can you keep those mitzvot? You have to learn the Torah teachings that will help you keep the mitzvot. In order to keep those mitzvot, you need to study Tanya and similar works. You need to study the spiritual dimension. So in order to keep the halakha of loving God and fearing God and having a true faith in the oneness of God, you need to study these mystical teachings which hitherto had been understood as being out of the realm of women. So then we come to a further stage. Once women are studying, not only, he also encouraged at a certain level for women to study Talmud as well, incidentally. Especially the book Ein Yaakov, which is a collection of all the ethical stories which are in the Talmud, and sometimes also regular Talmudic study with the backwards, the cut and thrust of the Talmud. Now, so now you then have the point within the 20th century where these different facets come together. You have the entrepreneurial dimension, which when the Lubavitcher Rebbe sent emissaries around the world and to all kinds of different situations, including here in Leeds and here in this building. So the idea is, this is a husband and wife team, and together they are going to try to work for the benefit of the community that they're in. And they will do this not under the mood of threat, as we saw Beatrice da Luna risking her life and saving lives physically, but in a situation with the help of God, a positive situation, helping people recognize the beauty of Judaism. And in order to do that, you need knowledge. You need the knowledge of the halakha. You need the spiritual empowerment that comes from the mystical dimension of thought. And in that way, you get the concept now of male and female emissaries, shluchim, and other people who are able to spread the excitement and the warmth of Judaism, and the woman's role is there at least as equal to the man. And I'm ending with a comment from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, where he discussed the different approach that men and women have to life. Men tend to go about life in terms of conquering things. Ish darkoi lichbosh. A man's style is to conquer. A woman's style is more to persuade the person that this is what they really want. The Lubavitcher Rebbe said this second technique is much cleverer and much more suitable for the challenges of our time. And so men should learn the woman's approach in order to really fulfill what has to be done today to fill the world with knowledge of God and bring the coming of Mashiach Tzidkenu. Thank you.
Yeah, unless there's any questions.
Well, you can.
Okay.
Fair
enough.
Sorry.
Caught you off. I'm
suddenly
the chairman.
Caught you off guard.
That's okay. I was going to say a few words of thanks, but before that, anybody got any questions that they want to want to ask Dr. Loventhal a very extensive run through the text and what have you, but the time's getting late. In that case, I'd just like to say a few words of thanks. Firstly, and particularly, I'd like to thank particularly Rabbi Engelfi for allowing the family to giving the family the opportunity to be part of this relocation of the library down here and making such a beautiful room here. I know it was been a particular project of my father that he's still thinking about all the time, ways that we can make this facility, this sort of, if you like, new facility in the town attractive. And I think it's no secret that we all realise that probably Lubavitch were the first organisation that really realised that to be able to attract people to come to educational events and to learn about Yiddishkeit, you really have to market it well. You have to have a good venue, a nice, comfortable venue, which we hope what this lovely room is. And also, of course, you need a good product that you're selling as well. And I think you'll all agree we've had a lovely lecture talk from Dr. Loventhal. Thank you so much for that. It's been very accessible and very interesting. It would be trite of me, I suppose, but I suppose you would all allow me to make immediate connections, as you started with Eishet Chayil, and of course my dear mother. I don't want to go through that too much, really, but only to say that a couple of things just struck me, talking about the lady Beatrice de Luna having to do all her trading, around the empire and what have you. Mum certainly never had to do that, but I know she used to tell me she used to be in the family business, which was the bakery business, and in the 1930s she was the one who was having to deliver up into Middlesbrough and Stockton. Now, going to Middlesbrough and Stockton isn't quite the same as going to Lisbon, from Lisbon to the Ottoman Empire, although I believe it was quite hairy on some occasions. But she was, so that struck me as well. And particularly as well, you were talking about Tachinus, this idea of praying before a mitzvah. I do remember as a little boy, when Mum would light candles, that I'd be waiting. She'd light the candles, and I'd be waiting, and I'd be waiting, and I'd be waiting, because she'd always be praying. And we were very lucky that all through our married life, until very, very recently, Helen and I and the kids would always have a Shabbos dinner with Mum. And quite often, again, we'd be there when she'd be lighting candles. And I think it's my recollection that praying beforehand got even longer and longer and longer. And I suppose as ladies get older and they've got grandchildren and what have you, there's more to pray about and more to think about. So that struck a chord as well. Thank you very, very much. As I say, Lubavitch have often realised you need a good venue, which thank God we've got now. You need a good product, and we've had a lovely talk this evening. And you also need a little bit of refreshment, which is what we've got as well. So maybe let's all move and have a drink and a l'chaim together and some refreshment. Thanks so much.